There's every color of the rainbow. Red roses, orange marigolds, yellow buttercups, green leaves, blue cornflower, indigo, lilacs, and violets, violets, my child's eye perceives. What a lot of flowers, what a lot of magic, what a lot of music in the world today. In among the flowers, I can dream I'll never be alone. What a world of happiness I've known through them. What a lot of flowers, what a lot of lovely, pretty flowers.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios This Week on Broadway for Sunday, December 25th, 2016. Merry Christmas. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast today we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Masterworks, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, Everything Sondheim, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
I should also say Happy Hanukkah and Merry Festivus. Is it Merry Festivus or Happy Festivus? Festivus for the rest of us and all the other celebrations of the end of the year that pertain to this point in the year. With us today, we have a very special guest. Charles Bush is joining us by telephone. Charles Bush is well known by people in the theater community for The Tale of the Allergist's Wife and so many, just countless numbers of performances that we have seen him on stage. And coming up on this New Year's Eve, he's going to be performing at Feinstein's 54 Below, and he also has a new live album. So we thought we'd come on and say hello to Charles and say thanks so much for coming on. So Charles, good morning.
Good morning. It's awfully early.
This is the no man's land for theater people, but it's usually the only time that we can get everybody together. And when we tell people, hey, we record at 9 in the morning, 10 in the morning.
Middle of the night.
Yeah. You sound a bit tuckered, Charles, yes.
Are you just getting in from the previous evening?
I still haven't hung up my coat yet.
What's the line from, I'm not sure if it's an Auntie Mame or Mame or both, when Vera wakes up in the morning. She's like, God, that moon is bright.
Yes.
And I just stay
up too late, you know, watching TV and that sort of thing. Yeah.
And I've seen Charles play Auntie Mame, indeed. Haven't you, Michael?
I would imagine. Oh, yes.
Yeah, right. A terrific
two occasions.
Yeah, I did it quite a way. Yeah, actually, the first time, a couple of times I did it, they were these sort of all-star actors fund one-night benefits. And the first time I did it, Peggy Cass played Gooch. She recreated her role as one of the greatest nights of my life.
Incredible.
Yeah. Thrilling.
So tell us about New Year's Eve. What are you going to be doing at Feinstein's 54 Below?
A couple new songs, which is always a little terrifying to do, particularly on New Year's Eve. My act, it's a very odd act, I have to say. Doesn't really make sense if you think about it too hard, you know, because I'm introduced as Charles Bush. Then, of course, I come out looking sort of like Greer Garson and Tina Louise, you know, and then proceed to just tell true stories about my experiences and sing songs by Sondheim and Jerome Kern. So it doesn't really, I don't really quite understand it, except that it seems to work. And So yeah, so I, you know, I'll be singing. What is something? I have a couple of new songs. I'm singing that wonderful Dolores Gray song, "Thanks a Lot, But No Thanks," from "It's Always Fair Weather," and I'm actually, I don't want to scare people away, but I'm actually going to try singing a Rick Vile song, "Surabaya Johnny." So I wanted to sing it for about 4 years, and Tom Judson, who's my musical director, and Svengali would never let me. You know, and you know, whatever happened to the concept of having a yes man? That's what I like to know. Anyway, everybody always tells me the truth. I don't know what happened there.
How dare they?
people always tell me the truth. You know, I don't like it, but anyway, but I take it anyway. So finally, Tom said, I wanted to do an entire evening of just depressing Kurt Vile songs, none of the uptunes. And Tom said, you can't ever, ever do that. So then he finally allowed me to sing this one grim song, but we've kind of given it a little bit of a twist to make it a bit more defiant.
Now, your live album from 54 Below, was that recorded in the summer? Is that right?
Last June, it was two performances. Yeah, you know, it's always been a fantasy of mine to have a record album. And when the idea was presented, you know, I was a little dubious. You know, I wasn't sure. You know, I come to cabaret really pretty late. You know, I've had chapters in my life where I've gone and done. Tiptoed into cabaret in the early 90s. I was working with Dick Gallagher, wonderful musical director. But then for the last 4 years, I've really, it's kind of been my career. And I've just loved it. But I wanted to make sure I was ready to or good enough that people would just want to hear me and not see me. You know, and so we tried it again, recording these two nights in June, and I don't know, I was leery about it, and so I gave the tapes to a couple friends of mine who are really, really brutally honest with me, and I said, all right, now listen, I'm leaning to not doing this, so you're not hurting my feelings, and then they were so encouraging, and so I thought, okay, and so we did it, and I'm very proud of the CD. It really does give a sense of what I've been doing for the past 4 years, and it's really as much a comedy album as it is a musical album, because I do a lot of talking, you know, in my act, you know, and somebody once told me that my intros were the uptunes. I think that's kind of true. So yes, so it can be enjoyed both as a music album and also as a live comedy album.
All right. Now, for those who cannot make it to New York on New Year's Eve, is there an analogy between what you did in June and the New Year's Eve performance?
Yes, it's very similar. We're doing some songs from New Year's. On New Year's Eve, we're doing some songs from the album. So it's, you know, New Year's Eve is a collection of old material, new material, somebody else's material. You know, it's just it's the best of.
Well, the song choices.
That's kind of what the album is too. You know, it's just the things that we've been doing, favorite songs of ours from the past couple of years that we've been doing.
Yeah, the song choices on the album are really wonderful. You have "Taking a Chance on Love," you have "Bill" from Showboat, "Summer Wind," the Sinatra song.
Yes. Well, you know, it's so funny. You know, Tom Judson, he really has an encyclopedic knowledge of popular song pre-1975, and so you know, sometimes he'll suggest a song title, and I'm so vague, you know, I don't know it, and then he plays it, and I, of course, you know, these are songs from the fabric of my youth, and so then we do it, and yeah, we you know, I used to poke fun of singers who did medleys. I thought it was kind of tacky or something, and well, I don't know what happened, but at this point I've never met a medley I haven't liked. We're always putting songs together, but I think it's because I'm really at heart a playwright, and so I do find it interesting taking two songs and putting them together. That it helps me even more create a narrative. which I love. Everything for me is a story. My whole life, everybody I meet is a story.
Well, two of the mini medleys, if that's the word for them, on this album are just really so great. You go from With So Little to Be Sure Of into another Sondheim song, Too Many Mornings.
I cribbed that from the great Julie Wilson. You know, last March, I guess it was.
Oh, yeah.
March? We did, it was an incredible night. For me, we did a night at Jazz at Lincoln Center, and we did a show called The Lady at the Mic, which is the only time I've done a theme show. And in that show, I paid tribute to a number of great ladies of New York nightlife, including Julie Wilson. And so I did these two songs that she had put together with Billy Roy on her great Sondheim album in the 70s. So it's a wonderful idea of putting those two songs together. Yeah.
And then you have, there are a few songs I think that sort of became somewhat famous out of the musical of Goodbye, Mr. Chips, but you sing one that hasn't. It's What a Lot of Flowers. I always love that song, and it goes, and then you go into Hurry, It's Lovely Up Here from On a Clear Day.
Yes. Well, you know, it comes out of a story I tell about my childhood. My childhood really was in many ways the plot of Auntie Mame. My mother died when I was seven, and my father was a lot of fun and not very reliable. And ultimately, I was adopted by my aunt, who took me to live with her in New York City when I was 12 years old. And when she got me, I was really in very bad shape. I was flunking out of school, and so she really had to kind of awaken me in our life together. And when I moved in there, it was kind of Auntie Mae mixed with the Miracle Worker, you know. And so she used everything at her disposal to somehow show me that I was not this isolated person, that you're, everybody is part of the world, you know. And so she, one of the things she used just to, was there, was she loved growing African violet plants, and she always had a big marble top table filled with about 12 plants going at the same time, and she insisted that I water them and somehow try to get at them, any way to pull me out of myself. And so I tell the story about that, and then I go into these songs, and the first song, What a Lot of Flowers, from Goodbye, Mr. Chips, is very much about sort of appreciation of the vulnerability of a flower, and we've changed the lyrics a bit, and then I take Hurry, It's Lovely Up Here, and you know, we I don't want to say that we take a lively song and make it grim, but it's a bit more of a thoughtful arrangement of, and in a certain sense, I'm talking to my younger, I'm my younger self, telling myself to pull up and disinter yourself, and you know, try to face life as difficult as it can be, and as scary as it can be, but ultimately you must.
That's were you really living great. In New York? Were you living in New York before you went to live with your aunt?
I was living in Westchester, in Hartsdale, that suburb about 40 minutes out of the city, but might as well have been a million miles psychologically and emotionally.
So therefore, we have your aunt to thank for the career you've had.
I thank her every day. I must say, you know, she died in 2000, and she was such an extraordinarily wise woman that I was just telling my sister on the phone. It's just we both find it so easy to channel her her wisdom that even. Just yesterday, I was gonna write some wacky email response to an old friend who I know we're having problems with our old friendship, and I was going to write this email, and then I'd sort of channeled my aunt, and she was saying to me, you know, do you think this is really going to make him change his mind? I thought, no. Is this going to make you feel better? No. And then Aunt Lillian said to me last night, leave him alone. And I thought, you know, it's just very easy for me to think of her, you know, advice. And I find it very helpful.
Have you seen Julie Halston in her new show?
Seeing it Wednesday.
Uh-huh.
And I'm so looking forward to seeing it. And, you know, Julie's my errant muse. You know, my God, by my calculations, I believe I've written about 12 roles for her in theater and the little bit of film work that we've done. And, you know, I just couldn't love her more. And so she's had a wonderful career outside of the work we've done together. And she's been, I think she literally has been in more Broadway shows than Gwen Verdon. You know, not in starring roles, but she has. And, you know, she has extraordinary will. And she's is just so delightful on stage. You know, I always think of when you watch her on stage, it's like having buttered toast and jam when you have a cold. She's just a real comfort. As soon as she comes on stage, it's kind of a comfort.
Well, yeah. Symbiosis has really gone on there. Both of you have really helped each other tremendously over the years.
Yes.
Now, the other night, Charles, there I was sitting behind you. The press agent gave you better seats. He knows who's important. at Bright Colors and Bold Patterns, which I thought was terrific. Did you like it?
Wasn't that fantastic? My God. Yeah, I never can pronounce Drew's last name. How do you pronounce it? Is it Drudgy?
I have no idea. I was hoping
Droege, and I've heard it pronounced every possible way. But anyway, I think he's brilliant, and he's kind of a new friend of mine. Basically.
Oh, is he?
Uh huh. Yeah. Well, years ago he played my old part in my play Red Scare on Sunset, I think in L.A. And we were in touch, and then, you know, we got on Facebook, you know, we kind of keep in touch. And then we finally last week got together for coffee, and then I went to see his play, and wow, I mean, it was so hysterically funny, but I really was taken with how much he reminded me of the work of Ruth Draper, the great monologist of the 20th century. And as soon as I went backstage, I mentioned Ruth Draper, and his eyes lit up, and he said, yes, indeed. You know, he was as influenced by her as I was when I was young. Yeah.
Well, now he seems to have hooked up professionally with Michael Urie, which can only be a good thing.
Yeah, well, he's so talented, too. My God. Yeah, no, I thought it was hysterically funny. And so he was just so skillful, you know, the way he could, you know, in this play listeners, you know, it's a solo play, but he's talking to different characters who we don't see on stage, and they become so vivid to us just through the way he's responding to them and interrupting them, interrupting himself. I mean, it took enormous skill. Oh, I was just dazzled. And I guess he's just playing. It's a very limited run.
He pronounces his name Droege.
Is it? So it's Droege. Okay, well, that makes sense. Droege. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you are not only somebody to be seen on stage very often, but in the audience supporting the New York Theater.
I don't go enough. No, I'm just terrible. You know, I remember when I was young and I knew this marvelous old curmudgeon Irish character actor, James Cahill. Do you remember James Cahill?
Mm-hmm. I know who you mean. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and he was marvelous, just real curmudgeon, you know, big drinker. And I was so young, and I asked him if he was going to see some play, and he said, no, I never go to the theater. It's like going to somebody else's half hour. And I was just appalled, you know, in my youthful
idealism,
exuberance. Yeah, so I was terrible, but I've turned into him. I'm too busy watching Survivor on TV to go to see, you know, Hamilton. Yeah.
All right, yeah. Here you are. What got you interested in theater in the first place? What was the first Broadway show you saw?
Oh well, you know, I grew up, you know, being so close to New York and having this wonderful aunt. I mean, before I actually went to live with her, you know, I was kind of spending every weekend with her anyway all my life, and so she started taking me to the theater when I was 7, and I think the first show we saw was Tvarich with Vivian Leigh, and I was, you know, a very special kid, you know, and appreciated everything I saw and had a rather extraordinary frame of reference early on. So when we saw Vivian Leigh when I was 8 or 9 years old, I'd already seen Gone with the Wind, so I was very aware of Vivian Leigh. I mean, it's funny when, you know, people are, you know, wondering what to take their children to see today, and everything has to be very child-friendly. And I thought, well, I went to, you know, when we went to the movies when I was 7 years old, I was taken to see Judgment at Nuremberg. and whatever happened to Baby Jane, and I turned out just fine. So but you know, it's like kids tune out on what they don't understand. That's what, you know, but I think parents get so afraid of things that are too erotic or this or that. Or and I remember, you know, my aunt would sometimes took me to these John Osborne plays like Inadmissible Evidence, you know, and I just went right over my head. I know what the hell they're talking about. I enjoyed looking at the set, you know, it was very realistic. And you know, it's funny about the sets. You know, we saw a lot of flop shows, you know, because my aunt would join the Macy's Theater Club, and we would, before the season would start, get a list of all the shows that are opening, and then you'd pick which shows it looked interesting and order your tickets, you know, months ahead before they ever opened. So it was a bit of a, you know, luck of the draw, I guess you'd call it. So we missed some of the big shows, but we saw a lot of famous flops. But, you know, I mean, Baker Street, you know, I don't really remember, you know, music or anything, but I just remember there was so much scenery, and for a impressionable, stage-struck, you know, 9-year-old or however I was, I just remember there was a Sherlock Holmes musical, and so there was a big chase scene, and the sets just kept changing. They were going through, like, tunnels and on stage, and, oh, gosh, you know, that probably made more of an impression on me than in a way when we saw Hello Dolly. You know, just, you know, it's, you know, different things would fascinate me. You know, just theatricality. A big influence on me, my father, you know, I really can't belittle his enormous influence on me. My father wanted to be an opera singer, and he had lovely voice, but it had a record store in Yonkers. Anyway, he took me to the old Metropolitan Opera House to see Joan Sutherland in La Sonnambula when I guess I was about 7, and that was probably had the greatest impact on me. Just the opera house itself, which was so, you know, just this Beaux-Art masterpiece and gold, and seeing this fantastic diva on stage. So yeah, I mean, that it did not instill any an interest in opera for me, but the theatricality of it, you know. And so yeah, and then my father also loved old movies, and so, you know, I would stay after my mother died. You know, my father was a completely permissive parent, and so, you know, I would stay up till, you know, 1 a.m. watching The Late Show with him every night, and, you know, and so that's really when I got my encyclopedic knowledge of of the women's picture or old movies. You know, really all my research was done before the age of 10.
And you've put that knowledge to use in comics.
I don't really, when I do a movie genre parody play, I really don't have to research it. You know, I know those movies. I've seen them all my life. And those actresses, the great iconic actresses of the 30s and 40s, and I just absorbed it as a very young kid.
Which of those movies do you think you've seen more than any other?
Now Voyager, probably. Uh-huh. It seems like whenever that's on Turner Classic Movies, I end up just turning it on. You wonder in a way when people say, "Oh, I've seen a movie 1,000 times," but really, literally, you know, it's probably only on once or twice a year. So, I mean, how many times have you really seen it? But yeah, there's certain movies, Random Harvest. I've just seen so many times, or some of the great Judy Garland movies I just see over and over.
But in addition to...
I'm trying to actually... But, you know, it's funny. Even somebody like me, who's kind of a film historian, there's some shocking gaps, you know, and I'm actually trying to fill those gaps lately to see some really classic movies that just somehow I never got around to see. So last week... You know, I blush to say, but I watched on Turner The Best Years of Our Lives for the very first time. It was one of the great, you know, American masterpieces, and The Awful Truth I'd never seen until about a year ago.
Wow, really?
Yeah, you know, mm-hmm. Most perfect romantic comedy ever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I have big gaps as far as the really great foreign films, and about 2 years ago I decided, I really have to educate myself, and so I watched Persona by Bergman and The 400 Blows and The Bicycle Thief, and just, you know, they're really great films. And it is interesting when movies are on the 10 best movies ever made list or whatever, there's a reason in each one of those movies. The Searchers, I really haven't seen many of the great westerns. You know, I tend to like girly westerns like Destry Rides Again, or Johnny Guitar, but I hadn't really seen the great John Ford western, so I said, I better, if I really want to call myself a film student, I have to see these things. So I watched The Searchers. I can see why people say it's one of the great films ever. I mean, there's a reason why these movies are acclaimed.
We've been talking about Knights of Cabiria because of, Sweet Charity's back. Did you get to Knights of Cabiria yet?
Oh, I'd seen that. I'd always seen that one.
Okay.
No, the early Fellini masterpieces. No, I've seen those. Oh God, I love Knights of Cabiria. I love Giulietta Masina. Mm. Yeah, I keep thinking that my friend Jen Cody would make an interesting charity because she really is like, she'd be like Giulietta Masina.
Yeah.
She's so tiny. She's 4'11" or something like that.
So it must discourage you when you hear young people today saying, "I won't watch a black and white movie," or "There's never been a good movie before 1980.
No, isn't that awful?
And it's true. It's
terrible. And the fact that it's so available, I get frustrated just the fact that things are so easy to see. But I guess in a way that's why people can avoid it.
Right.
You know, I mean, a lot of things, knowledge that we got, from our generation, just as far as research goes, you had to go to the library and you had to read the whole thing in a way, as opposed to, I need an answer to a question, so I'll just Google it, find out the answer, and then move on. You know, I was really lucky. Being a stage-struck kid living in New York City was, fantastic. And having access to the Library of Performing Arts, I really spent so much of my adolescence at that library. And, my aunt would give me a big coffee table book of pictures of great, great stars of the American stage. And I'd be flipping through the book, and then I'd see a picture of, Catherine Cornell, and be so taken with the majesty of her face. And then I'd go to the Lincoln Center Library, and you know, I could look just there in the research room, open up these enormous, heavy scrapbooks of just clippings of Catherine Cornell's great career, you know. But then maybe that would lead me to there'd be something about Eva Le Gallienne, and then that would take me down the rabbit hole to, you know, wanting to know more about her. And really, you know, it's funny. People associate, if they associate me with anything, it's Hollywood, interest in Hollywood history. But really, my real passion all my life has been theater history, you know. And in a way, I think when I was a kid, I think I was more fascinated by these great stage stars who were not accessible on film. Mm-hmm. You know, I think they fascinated me in a way more than Bette Davis and Norma Shearer, you know, who I could see their movies on the 4:30 mm-hmm. movie or the Late Show. But with my very heightened imagination, I almost preferred these rather mysterious figures of Lynn Fontanne or Le Gallienne, or that I could in a way imagine their voices. Does that make sense at all?
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. I've had the same experience about Lorette Taylor.
Well, I was just going to ask.
Lorette Taylor, who absolutely, I guess she's in a way the great ghost of the American theater, isn't she? That mm-hmm. she's so kind of denied us, and yet, you know, I suppose most theater people would say if they had a time machine and could see one performance, it would be to go back in time and see Laura Taylor in the Glass Menagerie.
Mm-hmm. Well, I assume Charles
all the way to go on.
I assume you did see that footage of her, that screen test that's included in Broadway.
What, oh my God!
What was that like after all those years of her being this remote, shadowy figure, to actually see that? What was your reaction to that footage?
Well, several things. First of all, it's amazing how long does it last? 4 minutes, if?
Yeah, if that.
You kind of get the whole thing. You understand it totally. Just, you know, and at one point it's she's so naturalistic, you think that she's forgotten her lines, but that's you know, that's part of this text. And you really are seeing, she's so in the moment, she's so, it just seems that she's just creating these words. She's fascinating. And I'm so obsessed with her that I had heard that that there's the only existing recording of her as Amanda Wingfield is on this radio recording radio show that she appeared on promoting that play, and the only existing copy was at the University of Texas. So I got it myself a gig in Austin just so I could go to that library. I appeared at the Austin International Drag Festival just so I could go to the Austin, Texas library. And of course I get there, you know, and it's a very, you know, it's an extraordinary facility. I had to get it was like getting a dispensation from the Pope. I mean, I had to go through all sorts of, you know, Sturm und Drang to get into the area with this, to hear this recording, and clearances. I mean, it was crazy. And of course, it turned out it's 6 minutes long, and you can, and she is, she does speaks four lines from the Glass Menagerie, but you know, any chance to hear her voice, it was worth it. And it was really cool, this library, and you had to put on gloves to look at any clippings, and it was wonderful. No, I find her just fascinating. But then it was an interesting thing, because you know, it was the screen test we're talking about was for a movie called The Young at Heart that David S. Selznick produced, and you see the screen test and you think, well, why didn't they just give her the part? For God's sake, she's so brilliant. And I finally watched the movie, and the way she sort of miscast, you kind of start to see why the role is actually is a rather simple kind of cute old lady And I think it's Mina Dufay. Who's the actress? Mina Dufay. I can't pronounce her name. Who plays it is much simpler actress than Lorette Taylor, who has a sort of eerie quality to her, and is even maybe a little too young for the part. So you think, oh, isn't it awful? The chance to, you know, to actually have this extraordinary historic actress in a real role in a movie, but she wasn't really right for it. Mm-hmm. Terrible.
So, Charles, thank you so much for coming on. Your show coming up on New Year's Eve at Feinstein's 54 Below.
7 o'clock. It's 7 o'clock, which I think is a very nice time to do a show in Midtown on New Year's Eve, because you can be out of there by 8:30 and to your next party and away from the madness of Times Square. So you can.
I want you
your cake and eat it.
I want you to bring a tape recorder with you, because I'm very interested after your show what the conversation between you and Jennifer Ashley Tepper is like. Because I'd imagine that the two of you can chat about theater history for days on end.
I've never really had an extended conversation with her.
Oh, your chance. Really? You should. Here's your opportunity, because I think that would be fascinating. In fact, we should have you both on, and we'll just sit back and listen to the two of you tell us
really?
About
these I didn't even. Of course, she's. Tell me more about her, because I don't really. I just know her from the.
From 54
of the club.
Yeah. Oh no, she's a theater historian, and this is all she's ever wanted to do in life. And she has written the three books, the history of the Broadway theaters. Each book is 8 Broadway theaters. So she's done the history of 24 Broadway theaters so far, and she's got a plan to cover all of the Broadway theaters. So check it out.
And not only that, if you hang around a little longer, the 11 o'clock show on New Year's Eve is Annalee Ashford.
Well, she's so wonderful.
So,
she's great.
That would be a great conversation also.
So pick up Charles's album, the live album from Feinstein's 54 Below, and he'll be there at 7 p.m. on New Year's Eve. And you can check Charles out at charlesbush.com, which will give you an extended view into everything that he has done, which is fascinating, plus that awesome New York Times piece that came out this week that you had written about your experiences of first time you performed in drag. Thank you for joining us, and we will speak with you soon.
It's been an absolute delight.
Then along came Bill, who's not the type at all. You meet him on the street and never notice him. His form and face and his manly grace are not the kind that you would find in a statue. And I can't explain, it's surely not his brain that makes me thrill.
Okay, in the review section, the three of us have gotten a chance to get down to the New York Theater Workshop and see Othello. So, Peter, why don't you tell us about Othello?
Well, what I will say about Othello, first and foremost, is that I hope it does move to Broadway, because that way people will have an easier time sitting through Othello, because once again, the New York Theater Workshop has decided to build some sort of strange contraption, really, when you think of it. You're not sitting in theater seats. You're sitting on benches in this completely wooden area. Wood everywhere, even on the ceiling, wood on the floor, wood. And it's very uncomfortable. So that – and, Othello is not a short show, needless to say. And it doesn't seem any shorter when you're sitting in those seats. Fine. Okay. But the play's the thing, right? And indeed, there's no question that this is a fine production of Othello. Stars, well, let's say Daniel Craig, because he's playing Iago, and Iago is one of the largest roles in Shakespeare, and it's a substantially larger role than Othello, because, of course, he's the villain, and as everybody knows, villains are always much more fun to play, and I think he's doing a fine job with it. we've had him around before on Broadway, and I think we're going to have him again because this production supposedly has been wanting to move to a theater. Of course, whether or not they find one is another story, but... He really gets into that jealousy factor because it's not just a story about Othello's jealousy, remember. Daniel Craig is very jealous because he's been passed over for a promotion. So it's jealousy all around. There are green-eyed monsters everywhere. David Olitolo, is that how it's pronounced? I don't know. I think does a fine job as Othello. The thing you really need to know more than anything else is it's a very unconventional production in that it seems to be taking place now, and it seems to be taking place in army barracks mostly. You see guys lying on mattresses much of the night, and it seems to be a barracks type of situation, even worse than barracks, in because at least in barracks you have like bunk beds. Here you just get a mattress and that's all there is to it. The horrors of war are really stressed in this one. There's even an amputee on the stage who takes off his prosthetic leg, so the realism is there. Sandgold wants us to feel that, and we certainly do. So the actress who played Desdemona was very atypical to me. She didn't seem at all as I expected a Desdemona to be. She was quirkier than any Desdemona I've seen in the past. That said, though, I do believe this is a fine production, if a maverick production, if a little on the strange side. It held my attention, but boy, could I have used a better seat.
So I'm the last person in the world to go for pronunciation, but I think it's David Oyelowo.
Please. Yeah. I believe you. So.
At least that's how Matt Temenini has been saying it.
He knows.
Yep. Yeah, seems
he
to knows. Know David from other things. all right, Michael, what did you think?
Well, I don't think there's no question that it's a fine production. I think it's there's a lot of bullshit going around, actually. But, you know, it really all depends on one's tolerance for obviously, if you take a Shakespeare play, any Shakespeare play, and you move it four or 500 years into the future, there are going to be problems in terms of references and character relationships and almost everything about the play except the basic human emotions, which of course remain the same, and that's why Shakespeare still speaks to us that in the language. But so it's always a question of what is lost and what is gained, and in this case I just don't understand the point of having every other line have a reference that takes you out of the fact that you're not really in Iraq in 2015 or whatever, because that's not what they're talking about. I mean, one of the main issues of the play is that Desdemona has a handkerchief that had been given to her by her husband, Othello. And it's not just a, you know, as we would use a handkerchief nowadays. In those days, a handkerchief, a lady's handkerchief, was a token, of like a favor that was given by her beloved. And I think there's even actually a handkerchief in the Camelot plot. Isn't that right, Peter? It comes in with the joust.
Yeah, Lancelot gives her.
Was that what you mean? I see what you're saying. Sorry, Yeah, I got you. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry to put you on the spot. Anyway, in those days. Yeah. So, all right. So a handkerchief, and they must say the word handkerchief about 12 times in Othello. And at one point, they even refer to it as a napkin. And the reason it becomes a plot point is that the handkerchief that Othello had given to Desdemona, I guess when they were courting or after they were married, is stolen by Iago in one way or another, and then planted in the room or barracks or whatever of Michael Cassio, the young officer, because Iago is going to try to make it look as if Desdemona and Cassio are doing it, and this is going to drive Othello crazy, which indeed it does. Iago's methods are still chilling all these hundreds of years later. The way he, the things he does to drive people crazy and make them hate each other and make them jealous of each other. It's kind of incredible that those methods have not changed in all those hundreds of years. I mean, the details may have changed, but not the overall way to do those things. So anyway, this handkerchief, but it's not a handkerchief. It's a long, kind of ratty looking woolen scarf. And so every time they said that, I was like, what are you talking about? It's not a handkerchief, it's a scarf. And also the way they use it is not the way one would use a handkerchief. So that's only one of about 500 examples of things. when it is discussed that when Iago gets Othello to the point where he's really thinking of killing his wife, the first method they discuss of killing his killing Desdemona is poison, and then the second method they discuss is strangling her in her bed. So here we are again in Iraq in present day, and this is how he is planning to kill her. Guns are not, of course, mentioned because there were no guns, and actually we don't see one until about 15 minutes before the end of the play when one of them goes off, and I won't talk any more about that, but that's another thing. And then, you know, Desdemona is supposed to be, she's not supposed to be one of the guys. She's not supposed to be among these grunts. She's supposed to be a lady. You know, she's not supposed to be sleeping in the barracks with them. It's just what kind of a story are we telling here? You know, just because you show people things that they've become more familiar with from modern day movies about Iraq doesn't mean, does that supposed to make them feel better? I can relate to that. I can relate to those images, whereas I can't relate to people dressed as if they were in the 16th century. I always sometimes think that maybe it just comes down to budgetary considerations, because it's a lot cheaper to do the kind of costumes that they did for this than what they would have had to do if they were trying to recreate Venice in the late 16th century. So I don't know. I would be interested in a concise answer from both of you as to what exactly you think is gained by having the text contradict what's happening at every other minute rather than doing it another way. Other than that, that said, I think both Daniel Craig and David Oyelowo managed to give wonderful, amazing, very intense performances. Especially, I was completely unfamiliar with David Oyelowo, so I'm now a fan of his, and I really look forward to seeing him in other things. I'm wondering if Matthew Marr, who played Roderigo, does anyone know if that's his actual voice?
I was going to ask about that. I can't imagine that it is.
I hope not.
I think that was an affectation of some sort.
I hope so. I he was in the flick, but and I don't recall that. So maybe not. And there was a joke about his voice. I mean, there's a line about the character's voice. So maybe that's why he did that. What else? In closing, at intermission, I really was really not having a good time. But I saw the great actress Lois Smith was at the performance I attended, and she at one point was kind of standing by herself, so I felt it okay to go up and say hi. I said, "How are you, Lois?" And she said, "Oh, I'm happy. I'm so very, very happy to be here. How are you? Are you happy to be here?" And I said, "Lois, it's so great to see you."
Yeah, I talked about how quirky the actress playing Desdemona. Her name is Rachel Brosnahan. I thought she was very, very poignant at one of the most tragic lines in Shakespeare when she says, "Kill me tomorrow, let me live tonight." But half an hour. What a sad line. I mean, when you think of the implications of that line, that if he says yes, and then the next day he comes back and says, okay, you've had your day, you've had your half hour, now I'm killing you. I mean, it's just such a powerful and sad line, and I thought you delivered it very, very well. Yeah, Michael, I can't disagree with what you're talking about the interpretation. I have a feeling, while you were talking about it, I guess I'm just inured to directors playing around with Shakespeare in this way. It didn't affect me badly, because when I went into that building and saw that construction, mm-hmm. I knew that I wasn't going to see a conventional production, and I went with it because it's very hard now to get a production of Shakespeare done straight. Mm. It doesn't happen very often, so I just go into a mode like that, but I certainly understand what you're talking about.
Well, but yeah, and I know what you're talking about, but for example, if they had all just done it in let's say in black clothing, mm-hmm. and not tried to make it look like Iraq, then that I think would have been better. If the specifics of the world that you put the play in contradict what's happening at every other line, I don't ultimately see what the point is.
All right. So I guess I'm falling down more on the side of Peter here in that I forgive so many updates of Shakespeare, and I'm not so attached to the text as perhaps Michael is. And I tremendously enjoyed this production. And I also thought to myself immediately when I walked in and looked at the setup and the way that it was staged there, is that they are very much looking at the Circle and Square Theater.
yeah.
And that in transit, has grosses that have not even broken $300,000 yet and are playing in the low 30% potential of grosses. Mm. I'd imagine that In Transit is probably going to close, and that Othello is going to go in there for a 12-week or 16-week run or something like that and compete in the Tonys, because I think this is amazing production. I think it's very well cast. David Oyelowo is unbelievable. Daniel Craig is great. The whole cast is very good, and I'm thrilled about this production. The cancellation line, I guess, is about 250 seats in New York Theatre Workshop, and the cancellation line the night that I was there was about 100 people deep. It was packed full of celebrities in there. I think that this is the type of thing that's a no-brainer to transfer for a short run and try to rack up some Tony nominations and awards and get in and get out of town pretty quickly. And so it is totally sold out. They are having a handful of benefit performances, which tickets are $2,500 to get to sit on a bench. So if you must see it, you do have the opportunity to perhaps get one of those tickets. Or, as I think that we're going to see the show up at Circle in the Square in the near future, and you'll be able to snag one of the couple of hundred seats that are in Circle in the Square when those tickets go on sale.
We should mention whether you love it, basically like these two guys, or basically hate it like I do. The director is Sam Gold, so he's the one who is responsible or to blame, or however you want to phrase it.
I hope In Transit does catch on. I think it's a very good show for millennials. It really talks. I'm rooting for it. I truly believe that. We always hear about how theater, Broadway is middle-aged tourists. Well, this is a show which does not speak to the middle age or the tourist. It's a very New York show, and I think it really deserves a shot. The night I was there, the young people were having a hell of a time, and I really hope that they spread the word and get their peers in there, because there's a lot to be said for In Transit, and especially the fact that there's no orchestra, and you don't miss it at all, because these people really are very good at blending their voices and making their own music. So the a cappella thing, I think you get used to very, very quickly. And I think it's an honest show, and I wish it well. And by the way, I'm not even sure that I'm guessing now, this is not like I've heard anything, I'm not even sure that Othello would be interested in Circle in the Square, because it isn't a big theater. You're not going to get big grosses there. Granted, you don't have to pay the playwright. No question about that. But the fact still remains, I'm sure they're looking for a Broadway theater where they can really rack up the grosses. And the Circle and the Square is one of our smallest Broadway theaters.
Yeah, they go with $500 tickets at the Circle and the Square, which would be the equivalent of tripling the size of the in the traffic jam of Broadway theaters, Circle and Square is probably the only option they have for the next year.
And plus the fact that, as James said, the setup is you could just move it there. I mean, the staging.
Oh, no, I'll set there. But we've all seen a lot of shows go into theaters that are wrong for them, per se.
Yes.
I put quotation marks around the word wrong because they want bigger grosses. And given the fact that you're talking about 100 people waiting in line and benefit tickets for $2,500, I have a feeling they're hoping that one of these other shows close. And I wouldn't be surprised if they're very happy if In Transit stays at Circle in the Square.
Okay. So there is Othello at New York Theater Workshop, which is playing through the end of through January 18th, 2017. So only for another couple of weeks, and then we'll have to see what happens. Last week, Michael and Jenna talked about Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812. Peter, you haven't weighed in yet on Natasha Pierre. And were you one of the people that saw it twice?
Yeah, in fact, yes, because the understudy was in when Josh Groban was out. So this is a show that has done very, very well with the critics as well as audiences. It's very impressive how people have taken to it. I've seen that this is the one that is on more 10 best lists than any other show. And I have no issue with that whatsoever. I do think that sometimes it's very hard to follow. Now that Rachel Chafkin has taken an environmental approach here in the Imperial, where we're not used to that type of approaches, there are no realistic sets at all. The set even vaguely resembles the Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. vaguely. We have a lot of red, a lot of gold railing. So seats have been removed in the house, all that kind of business. So people are running around. It's a very, very fine show. I'm very happy with it. I love listening to it. The music, Dave Malloy really went out on a limb in this. Sometimes the music's anachronistic, I'll grant you, for the early 19th century, but not enough to make the whole thing sound wrong. War and Peace is a tough thing. Betty Comden and Adolph Green used to joke about making a musical of War and Peace. Of course, he hasn't really done a full musical of War and Peace because all he did was take 70 pages of it. You know, there are 365 chapters in the book. So if you want to read one a day, you can do it in a year, you know. But he just centered on one aspect of it. I want to be helpful here. And instead of telling you how wonderful the show is, I want to help you if you're a little afraid of Russian names, and because, you know, there are all the nicknames and all that kind of stuff, and keeping everybody straight isn't easy, especially where people are popping up all around and there are no realistic sets. So Natasha and Sonia, okay, they seem very sister-like, but they're cousins. And so you can remember Natasha begins with an N and Sonia begins with an S. So they're not sisters, okay? N and S for not sisters, Natasha and Sonia. So we can help you there with that. So you'll remember that. And by the way, she's Countess Natasha, okay? And she's in love with Andre, but he's off fighting the War of 1812. No, that's not our War of 1812. Russia had one too, as you probably know from the famous 1812 overture. So now, will Andre's absence make the heart grow fonder? Or will this be a case of out of sight, out of mind? Okay. So, a mnemonic device with their love now be N-A, not applicable. So, all right. So Natasha's discouraged after she meets her prospective in-laws. She's a countess. Bolkonsky is a prince. And his daughter Mary is a princess. So that trumps countess. You know, they're much so. So their initials are B and M. And believe me, they treat Natasha as if she were a BM. So keep that in mind as well. I do think Chelsea Bell is very good as Mary, by the way. And I don't think you'll ever guess that Nicholas Belton, who plays Bolkonsky, is the same actor who will play Andre later on. Very good versatility there. So I thought that was very fine. Well, anyway, so she goes to the opera and she spies Anatole, and here's that famous love at first sight thing again that so many musicals employ. Not, of course, that Malloy thought of this. This is Tolstoy. But just one look at someone's look, and it's magic, you know. So God forbid that Tolstoy could have given the other lover a name with a different initial so he wouldn't confuse Andre with Anatole, but you'll have to remember that alphabetically Anatole comes before Andre, and Anatole is now first in Natasha's heart, so that will help you there. I have to say, I didn't get that from the casting of Lucas Steele. He has punk rock looks, and the way Chafkin has him playing it is very much a see-through phony. I lose respect for Natasha when she sings to him, "Anatole, you are kind, noble, and splendid," because I can't find any of these characteristics in this actor or this character. By the way, he's married, okay? So we start to feel better about him when he begins to sing to her, "I am mad," and you think, oh, he's going to tell her that he's married. No, he says, "I am madly in love with you, you know, so I'll do anything for you." Yeah, does that include leaving his wife, you know? So anyway, we have an eternal triangle here, as we have all the time. So what about Pierre? We haven't heard about Pierre. Yes, it's amazing to me that Josh Groban took this role for his Broadway debut, because it's not, despite his being in the title, it's not a major role. It's definitely a supporting role. It'll be very, very interesting to me to see where he goes in the Tony race, if what category he'll be in. He really should be in the supporting category. I don't think that's going to happen, but that's exactly what this role is. It's a supporting role. So he's married to Helene, okay? So, but she's been cavorting with Dolokhov for a while. So you can, Helene and Dolokhov, HD, you know, high definition, which is where their romance is compared to Helene and Pierre's, which is very low definition. So anyway, Amber Gray, by the way, plays her, and she's very, very fine. She has a song called Charming, and she's not just charming in that song, she's thrilling. So anyway, Pierre is, you know, this schlubby guy. I mean, you know, he's made so little happen with his life, so little. He's just a boring guy, you know, and you can recall, you can remember that he's boring by the fact that his name is Pierre, just like the capital of South Dakota, where I've been. It's a very boring town. So anyway, you know, Pierre participates in 10 songs. You know, but I still say it's a supporting role because he only solos in 3 of them. You know, I'm just very surprised he took the part. And I have a feeling that people who go there to see him have to come away disappointed that he's not driving the action, especially because the character doesn't drive the action. So anyway, and the Great Comet, you know, that really happened. That's not fiction. In 1812, there was a big comet that stayed around for 260 days. And that record lasted for almost 200 years. And you know, I have a feeling you're going to root that the show stays around for longer than 260 days because it is something to see. We don't get anything like this on Broadway very often. And it's as much a party, even though you do get a little bit of this, that, and the other thing to eat and drink if you're in the right place at the right time. But there is a party feel to it as well, even though we're dealing with a very serious story. So I'm not surprised that this has shown up in so many 10 best lists. And I think it's going to be around for a long time. What's interesting to me, too, is that it's now at the Imperial. And if you stand in front of the Imperial, to the left of it, there is an empty space. And that's where Natasha and Pierre was for a while, in a tent there. I wonder when it was there if they ever thought that it was going to move next door into the big time. I doubt that they did at that point in time, but there are enough people behind it to move it next door. And I think it's really quite wonderful that it's made quite a leap from a little tent to the Imperial Theater.
It's made its move from Ars Nova to the tent to the Imperial Mix. Next stop, maybe Radio City.
By the way, the comet.
That's where Othello's going, to Radio City.
Yeah, they could sell it out, right?
$500 a seat, yeah.
The comet, by the way, I had always assumed it was Halley's Comet, but I looked it up and it's not, just in case there's any question about that. But yeah.
Well, I have learned a few things this morning because I had no idea the 1812 Overture was not about the American 1812 war, and the comet as well. So excellent. So, as I mentioned, Michael and Jenna gave us great reviews of that last week, as well as talked about the understudy for Josh Groban, who is a star in his own right. So, if you missed that, get back to last week's show and take a listen to that review, which was really insightful as well. Michael and I got a chance to see Richard Greenberg's new show, The Babylon Line, at Lincoln Center Theater. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
Okay, I think James liked it a lot more than I did. It started out very well. I thought it's a very intriguing setup of this writing class in Levittown that's being given by this fellow named Aaron Port, P-O-R-T, which I always – that kind of like was a little jolt for me because I used to give that as my name when I would do student teaching and such, rather than expect them to say Portantieri. So I don't know. Port sounds to me like it's always a shortened version of something. I don't think there was any mention of this fellow having a longer name that he had shortened. But anyway, that's his name. And he comes in, and it's this fairly small class of for creative writing. And a lot of the students are what you would expect, but then there are a couple of wild cards. There's this younger guy named Mark, who is played by Michael Oberholzer, and he seems like there's something a little bit off about him. The other male in the class is Frank Wood, plays this guy named Jack, and he's pretty quiet until he finally starts to read some of the things he's written. The other women are I guess the other three people in the class are a little more stereotypical, what you would sort of think of as middle class Long Island, probably Jewish women. And they are played by Randy Graff, Maddie Corman, and Julie Halston. But then the other person in the cast, and here's the rub, is this character named Jean Delamond, played by Elizabeth Reaser. Now, she is supposed to be an outsider. She at one point has a line about when she starts to talk with the teacher, Aaron, when they're alone. On one of the occasions when they're alone, she references that she was basically an army brat. She doesn't, I don't think, say anything more specific than that, but we're supposed to think she's not from the area. And I guess maybe that justified what sounded to me like a Southern accent. But aside from a Southern accent, I don't know. It's funny. Right, like 2 days later, I spoke with a friend who saw this show, and he said, "I hated that Mary Louise Parker thing she was doing." And I said, "That's interesting you say that, because the person I thought of was Jennifer Jason Leigh." All of these actresses, they choose, I guess, on many occasions to use very, very odd affected modes of speech that I guess commands attention from an audience to a certain extent, but in many cases, as in this case, I just thought I wanted to stop listening to it long before she stopped talking. Just the whole quality of the voice and the inflections and the tone, and I really really did not like listening to it. And aside from the fact that this character seems very, very sketchy as far as what she is trying to do and the kind of relationship she's trying to forge with the teacher. So I thought that her character was quite off-putting, and it's not necessarily a bad thing to have an off-putting character in a play. See above Iago in Othello. But it depends on how it's handled and how much of that person you have to see. And so I just really didn't think that as the play went on, I liked it less and less because her character became more and more prominent. I think there are some, as I said, I like the setup a lot. I think that a writing class is a setup for a play, a writing class of a bunch of people who really have never written before. I think that has a lot of potential. I just don't think it was really realized in this case. And some of the writing by Richard Greenberg is very good, but it also has that thing he does a lot where normal people, when they're supposed to be doing regular dialogue, not when they're reading their stories, which is something else entirely, but some of their regular dialogue sounds very lofty and fruity and poetic. And he's done that on several occasions. So that's just a method he likes to use, but I don't particularly find it effective. So that's that. And another notable point is that this play is directed by Terry Kinney. So that maybe he brings that own special sensibility to it. And it's in the new house up at Lincoln Center, and it's a nice intimate setting for it. But I just I found it very inconsistent, and moments I liked greatly, most of them involving Randy Graff or Julie Halston or Maddie Corman, and then other parts I really didn't like. Oh, and another thing, just in ending, I don't know what choices Josh Radner was making in terms of, it seemed to me that he, from the beginning, from the very first moment when we first see him in front of these people at the first class, he seemed extremely uncomfortable and unhappy and really not wanting to be there, not making eye contact, having a very sour expression on his face. And I thought, what teacher, you know, would ever do that, and how long would that person last? So I don't know if that was his choice or the director's choice. I think it was a terrible choice, and I think they should maybe look at the play a little bit more when deciding what affect the actor should have.
So I'm probably the exact opposite of Michael here. I really enjoyed it, and I didn't find the problems that that Michael had here with it. Elizabeth Reeser, I've seen her in a few different things, and that Southern accent thing. Michael and I were sitting actually next to each other in the theater.
Yes.
We happened to arrive at the same time. And said, "Hey, how you doing?" So we talked about this a little bit there at the theater. Is the Southern thing? It must be a directorial choice, or Rich Greenberg asked for it, because we talked to Richard on This Week on Broadway a few months ago, back when they first started rehearsal, and he was actually there for every rehearsal and participating in the development process there. So I feel like it has to have been a choice, because I haven't seen Elizabeth Reeser do sort of accents and other things, and I'm not sure where that came from, if that was some whatever. But
as I said, she does have a reference to being an army brat.
Yeah.
So that in itself is not inappropriate. It was just the eccentricities on top of that bothered me, but apparently didn't bother you.
No. And as for Maddie Corman, Randy Graff, and Julie Halston, wow. You know, for people who don't have a lot of lines, the three of them really command the stage. I think this is very well cast. And with the three women, Maddie Corman, Randy Graff, and Julie Halston on one side of the stage in the classroom, and Michael Oberholzer and Frank Wood and Elizabeth Reeser on the other side, I really enjoyed this, and I wasn't really sure I was going to. But it struck home for me, and maybe because of a lot of the local stuff. I grew up right in that area, and when they had mentioned some of the local landmarks, it really doesn't mean anything to anybody else that they were going to Jan's for ice cream. But Jan's is an institution on Long Island for ice cream. After the going to the Levittown roller rink or going bowling or something, you always went to Jan's. That was like the big thing when I was growing up. We went to Jan's. And so maybe that meant more to me than it did to somebody else who was like, oh yeah, Jan's, what, that doesn't mean anything. So perhaps I have I'm predisposed to like a little bit more because it's local to me. And
Things like that always help a little bit.
Yeah.
Of course. My late great friend David Wolf was the most sour person when it came to responding to shows. The fight we had after Once in This Island is still, I'm sure, talked about by people passing by in the street because we were yelling, screaming, carrying on, so on. So I was very pro. He was very con. But anyway, my point is, for all the times that I have seen David groan at jokes, one time at some show, somebody mentioned Jerome Avenue and he burst out laughing because he used to live there, you know? So yeah, those things really pack a wallop. No question.
He would have loved a Bronx Tale then.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
On a somewhat related note, for those who've been following Richard Greenberg's plays, there is a reference in this play to Our Mother's Brief Affair, a passing reference, which I thought was kind of ballsy in the sense that really was not well received at all. but there it is. You know, I mean, it's only about 15 seconds or less. But
which brings up a good point about it's only a play. Remember when Nathan Lane's character said, "What do I know? I like the Addams Family." I wonder if that was Terrence McNally's line or if Nathan Lane said, "Hey, I got a good idea." You know, whoever sees either one of them first asks the question.
So I think that I had I have an answer about that whole Josh Radnor character choice of not being happy about being there. I think that he is really embarrassed and not happy about being teaching this class in Levittown. I think he sort of feels that it's beneath him and what he should be doing as a writer, and has been, you know, quote unquote stuck, as we've is mentioned a few times in the play. I think it's probably, you know, maybe a little bit of Richard Greenberg thinking, I'm not going back to Long Island to teach while my writing is not paying the bills. And he talks about exactly how much money he makes to teach this class, and that why he does it, and that it's a couple of hours and it pays the bills and things like that. I think that that's exactly what they were getting at, but
absolutely agree. But you don't go in and like not make eye contact and look down and say things like, "All right, who are we going to hear from next?" You know, I mean, that's what he was doing. I think it would have been more effective if we saw him trying to make it look like he wanted to be there and trying really hard to be positive but not succeeding.
Have you never had a more likely a professor in college rather than a teacher in grade school, middle school, or high school, but a professor in college who really should not be teaching but has to do it as part of their professorship and looks down and I think that maybe, I don't know.
I guess I've been lucky. No, I have not had that.
Oh, yeah. I've had a handful of those in my 80 years of college. feels like I mean,
what
scholar.
What I thought when I was watching this was that the way he addressed them in that first class, I thought every single one of those people would march to the bursar or the registrar and say, "I'm dropping this shit."
Well, the French cooking class was filled.
That's right. The French cooking class was filled.
That's why we're taking this class. So, which is discouraging
James,
to him. Yes.
James, 80 years of college?
Yeah, I seem to have spent a lot of time and money in college. Getting a lot of degrees that have nothing to do with making a podcast. So
that's what we call 6 degrees of education, right?
That's also what we call life.
I tell you. Don't go to NYU if you don't know what you're going to do, because it's an expensive time to waste time there.
Well, I suppose it is.
Anyway, so that's the Babylon Line at Lincoln Center Theater. I really loved it. Michael, maybe not so much. So if you see it, please touch base with the three of us and let us know how you felt about it. All right, Peter, we missed you last week while you were at the Drama Desk executive meeting. So give us the answer to the trivia from 2 weeks ago.
All right. I asked, what do the 20th century years of 1934, 36, 43, 52, 56, 62, and 68 have in common? And the answer is, all those years saw a New Faces review produced by Leonard Sillman. John Baccarella was the first to get it, followed by Fred Abramowitz, Donald Tessioni, and Brigadude. I love that name. I don't know who he or she is, but Brigadude occasionally chimes in, and I'm very grateful for Brigadoon's attention. All right. This one's really funky. This one may not qualify as a Christmas present, but anyway. There's a great 11 o'clock number in a 60s Broadway musical that has three words in it. The first two of those words are the same two words of the name of a 70s Broadway flop. The irony is that the third word of the flop's title eventually turns up in the lyric of that 11 o'clock number. What's more, the 11 o'clock number also happens to mention a musical from the 50s, the 70s, and the 80s. Okay, so what's the name of the 11 o'clock number, the show from which it came, the name of the 70s flop, and the musicals from the 50s, 70s, and 80s that are named in the song? I'm exhausted, aren't you? I mean, you know, but anyway. It's really simpler than it sounds, I'll grant you that. So we'll see what happens.
All right, and as Monday is a national holiday, maybe you'll have some extra time to figure this out. If you do know the answer, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com, and we'll let you know if you're on the right track. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos this week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
If there are storm clouds riding across a winter's sky, sail away. Sail away. If a love light is fading in your sweetheart's eye, sail away, sail away. If you feel your song is orchestrated wrong, why should you prolong your stay? When the wind and the weather blow your dreams sky high, sail away, sail away, sail away. But when soon or late you recognize your fate, that will be your great, great day. On the wings of the morning with your own true love, sail away, sail away, sail away. Bless you, darlings. We really just have one more song other than the fake encore. Yeah, yeah. This is Meta Cabaret. You didn't know that, yeah. Meta Cabaret.